Welcome to the Esri and the Science of War podcast. David Yarnold wanted to write a book about hope. It's called The Geography of Hope, Real-Life Stories of Optimists Mapping a Better World. Through the stories of exceptional people mapping to improve the world, David Yarnold wanted to highlight a creative approach to problem solving. Because he knows, it works. David Yarnold is known for helming the Audubon Society. That's where he saw how using the capabilities for creating, analyzing, mapping, and sharing all types of data helped modernize the Audubon Society, one of the largest conservation organizations in the world.
People really were hungry for an Audubon that brought in new members, that felt more contemporary, that used technology, and that could be powerful. So there was an extraordinary amount of goodwill.
David Yarnold describes to Esri's chief marketing officer, Mariana Cantor, how seeing and analyzing relationships and patterns helped the Audubon Society increase its impact.
Hello, David, and welcome to the Esri and the Science Aware podcast.
Thanks, Mariana. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with the book you just wrote, The Geography of Hope, Real-Life Stories of Optimists Mapping a Better World. Why did you want to write this book?
I wanted to write the book because I was deeply moved by the people I had met in the geographic information system technology, or GIS world, and how effective they are in using visual storytelling to help change the world. Everywhere I went, I found stories I didn't expect. I went to Prague to tell the stories about how GIS teams help manage cities and governments all around the world. What I didn't expect to find was this team that was not only democratizing data, but democratizing democracy in the face of autocrats and former communists who have only been out of power for a few decades and wanted to end the citizen engagement that the GIS experts were able to foster in Prague. In Prague, the GIS team and community is a hub for citizen engagement. People who want to make sure that there are pediatricians in their neighborhoods. They want to make sure that they have enough transit stops. And the GIS team in Prague is this advocate for participation.
So essentially, you wanted to write stories about GIS heroes, if you will. How did you pick the subjects of the 9 very different chapters?
I decided I wanted to write the book after coming to user conferences in San Diego. And the inspiration for the book was in 2015, when we were lucky enough to win the President's Award. That afternoon, a doctor from the World Health Organization spoke and talked about how he was ending Ebola using GIS. And I remember sitting in between the oceanographer Sylvia Earle and another famous scientist, and I had a severe case of imposter syndrome. And I remember seeing Dr. Bruce Aylward, and I thought, this is amazing the way people change the world using GIS. And it was 7 years later that I proposed to Esri CEO Jack Dangermond that we write a book about people stories, not about technology, but about how hard it is to make change in the world. And that conversation lasted less than an hour, and before we were done, we had a deal to do a book. So I picked the chapters by starting with, I needed a framework of some kind. So I looked at Esri's dominant vertical markets like public safety, government, nonprofits, military intelligence. And I must have talked to 50 people, mostly inside Esri, to try to find really good subjects. I used 3 criteria to arrive at those topics. Number one was, were they representative of a very large swath of users? 2, were they doing work that reflected the cutting edge of the use of the technology? And 3, as a storyteller, were they interesting? And there were plenty of people who and organizations that checked a couple of those boxes, but not the critical third one.
So you mentioned that you won an award in 2015. And that's when you were the CEO of the Audubon Society. It helped pass critical legislation to protect birds, other wildlife, clean air and water, wetlands and rivers. I think many people may not know about all this, so I wanted to mention it. And you were brought in as the CEO in 2010 for how it was framed as your pragmatism and impressive track record of making change happen. So I want to explore that because a lot of leaders listen to our podcasts. So when you took over the position, what was your first impression of the organization?
There was some terrific work being done in states and in communities, but the sum of the parts were just parts. It didn't actually add up to something larger. And so that was my first impression. And I started with a month on the road interviewing people using my journalistic skills, such as they are. And people told me this amazing story about birds that later became our animating vision. But they also gave me a really clear and candid assessment of Audubon. And it was clear that there was a lot of work to be done. Do I believe that first impressions are accurate? I think that things are generally worse than you're led to believe during an interview process. I think that that's just part of the process.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that the organization was fractured, and it's a large organization.
2 million members.
Uh-huh.
And an annual budget of more than $150 million.
And it's highly distributed with national state offices, nature centers, sanctuaries, and hundreds of local chapters. So in the past, and when you took over, this distributed framework caused some tensions, clearly, that were unproductive. So how did you balance local and central operations and decision-making towards the same organizational goals?
My first job was to create an animating vision that everybody, that would enable everybody to see themselves as a part of something big and important and charismatic. And people told me this amazing story about the four superhighways in the sky that birds use across the Western Hemisphere, and that Audubon's job was to protect the homes and rest stops underneath those four superhighways. They hang out in places while they're migrating, and they have places where they live. And so as people told me these stories about what are called the flyways of the Americas, which was a phrase that was coined by the Fish and Wildlife Service in the 1930s, it just seemed to me to be this really great image of what's happening that we can't see up above us. And it turned out to be a really compelling idea. And so the first thing that I did to make sure that everybody saw themselves and saw the benefits of working toward a common goal was to help them see themselves in this big, compelling vision of Audubon that spoke to its history and its future. What surprised me was how well it worked. People really were hungry for an Audubon that brought in new members, that felt more contemporary, that used technology, and that could be powerful and create legislative change. And so there was generally an extraordinary amount of goodwill, but as is always the case with a distributed organization, it all comes down to fundraising and finding a way to raise money so that state offices and local nature centers and even our chapters could share in that was a really important task.
Did it help that your vision was visual, that you created an actual visual representation of these flyways that you could share with the various distributed stakeholders? And how did these data visualizations help build trust?
There's no question that the animating vision of these four superhighways in the sky, and the way we were able to draw that for the first time gave people a sense that they belonged to something big and important. And the fact that we were able to use GIS and other mapping tools helped everybody understand what they were working on.
Were there other management tools besides the technology and the great communication storytelling that you brought into this role that you would want to share that were useful?
When I look back on my 11 years at Audubon, the first few were really an exercise in storytelling. And this is true for nonprofits and businesses of all types. I think that most organizations just don't tell their stories very well. And we focused on telling Audubon's story because it was a terrific story, and people take birds personally. I had no idea how compelling birds were for millions and millions of people, that birds stirred memories of the places where they vacationed or where they were kids or where they lived, you know, their own backyards. And being able to talk to people about something that they were passionate about mattered a lot. In terms of management tools, we did all of the things that you would expect. We controlled costs better. We leveraged our size by buying technology at scale. You know, we replaced old beaten up machines. We rebuilt a marketing and communications function. When I started at Audubon, there were three marketing people and two national development people. Mm-hmm. And that was the result of more than a decade of losing money and cutting costs. And I just don't know very many organizations that have cut their way to success. So it was my job to go out and raise money to build strategically while we were cutting costs.
During your tenure there, membership increased from 200,000 to 2 million people, and the funding, which you were key in securing for conservation, doubled. It became 150 million a year. In a Harvard Business School case study that was written about this, you were quoted saying, "The key to a speedy turnaround was to start with the best possible ideas and to enlist buy-in from the most talented or influential staff first. Others would follow." Talk to us about that approach.
That was an approach I used when I ran the newspaper in San Jose, California. It was an approach I used when I was executive director at Environmental Defense Fund. I think maybe it comes from my time in Silicon Valley. By talking to the early adopters, I think today we'd probably call them influencers, and having them be evangelists, that's the only way to spread the word widely in a distributed organization. And I focused a lot of my time and attention in my first year or two on identifying who those 20 to 30 opinion leaders were, that worked. I also came to that role at Audubon believing three things. Organizations can change faster and more dramatically than they think they can, even while being nimble and inclusive. I believe that people want to belong to something important and meaningful, and I believe in the power of just getting started. We all know organizations that have suffered from analyzing problems to death. I think that learning on the fly, unless you're in a mission-critical organization and lives are on the line, that learning by doing is the surest path to success.
David, I know you mentioned GIS several times. I want to dig into the technology's role in this transformation at Audubon. In the same case study I mentioned, you were quoted as saying that what Esri did was give a scientifically valid look at much larger landscape than the artificial boundaries that state boundaries create. Of course, birds don't recognize state boundaries. And we got a glimpse of what the future could be. So how did you use this geographic approach and GIS to achieve your business and organizational goals?
So it starts with the Flyways vision. Once we agreed that the Flyways of the Americas, those superhighways in the sky, could be an animating vision, and that we would protect the rest stops and homes for birds as they traveled up and down the Western Hemisphere, the question became pretty obvious. What are those places? And when I first started at Audubon, I remember a meeting where seven state directors all came into this meeting of Northeastern state directors, and they all had PDFs from different consultants that showed that their states and their birds were the most important places and birds to protect, which was terrific, and, you know, I applaud their initiative. But by using GIS and taking a hemispheric approach, we were able to arrive at a scientifically valid set of birds and places that we were all able to agree on and that I was able to raise money around.
David, I want to come back to leadership. It's a particular interest of mine, and your career has exhibited much success there. One of the first things you did when you assumed leadership at Audubon is to take to the road looking for a story. And you mentioned in your journalistic background, you are drawn to storytelling. And you were looking for a story that would connect to your new vision. I'd like to talk to you about you being a journalist at heart, and how does that affect how you learn, how you lead, how you view the world?
If you're a photojournalist, like I am, you're looking for the images that convey the things that you believe are happening in front of you or are happening behind the scenes. So I think that storytelling is at the heart of organizational development and growth, especially for nonprofits. But I think for any organization, I mean, even when I look at Esri and how hard it is to tell the story of what GIS does, I think that storytellers are greatly undervalued in most organizations, and lots of organizations that have put storytellers in the lead have found real success. Because at the end of the day, that is what differentiates one organization from another. It is, of course, the things that you do, but it's the way that you talk about them. And the competition for people's time and attention has never been more fierce. And the ability, whether through social media or through a vision or through, you know, other forms of media, the ability to be able to help people feel that they're a part of something compelling is rewarding for the customer. And, you know, what a great thing to be able to provide to people. People now especially just see through slogans and pitches. And the thing about Audubon that was terrific was that birds have always been known to be the canary in the coal mine when it comes to things like climate change. So being grounded with an authentic story has to be the starting point. There's really no other option. And I think, you know, I also, when I did the Geography of Hope and I wanted to focus on people making change in the world, I focused on what they did, not what they said. And I started with what they did because those things were true. And it was as I was telling those stories that big, important storylines emerged, to my surprise.
You also mentioned that technology and data can provide a certain grounding of that truth. And in these highly polarized times, and you talked about finding common ground, is indeed challenging. And you have said that democratization of data helps find common ground and mold a collective worldview. Talk to us a little more about that.
It's been my experience that when people collaborate through visual media, like GIS-based tools, maps, dashboards, whatever, that they can suspend their partisanship and they can focus on working the problem. And I saw that from Nairobi to Prague to my own offices in Sacramento or New York at Audubon. I find that when people believe that the science is helping them arrive at a productive solution, that they'll just roll up their sleeves and get to work.
David, it was a great pleasure of mine to be speaking with you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Where podcast. And thanks to David Yarnold. Read David Yarnold's book, The Geography of Hope, Real-Life Stories of Optimists Mapping a Better World. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.